Chapter 11. When the attack came, I do not suppose I was entirely surprised. We had been aware of the possibility of ambush before we even entered this system, and even as I raced towards it, I had my doubts about the legitimacy of the distress signal. But there was still no warning when the weapons opened fire. Fortune smiled on me, however, for I had just disengaged the engine, using friction from the debris cloud to effect my final slowdown into the rest frame of the signal. Had I still been making the course change, I would have been fatally weakened during those instants when the field was diminished. Instead of incinerating dalliance in a few moments, the assault merely tested her defenses to the limit. More energy was pumped into the bubble in a second than it had absorbed through all the collisions it had sustained since entering the veil. Emergency measures snapped into immediate effect before I could even think of giving an order. Throughout the ship, Impassos created secondary bubbles to encase vital systems and cargo, including myself. Even if the main bubble collapsed and the ship was ripped apart, some of those interior bubbles might still survive. It would be like a fish spilling eggs from its gut, even as it was torn asunder. I had a few numb seconds during which to wonder how long the main bubble could hold before collapsing. On the console, floating over me, a red line was creeping inexorably to the right. If the beam maintained its strength, dalliance would not survive more than another 30 seconds. My every instinct screamed for me to steer out of the beam's reach, but that was impossible. Then it ended, and I was still alive. I could only presume that the weapon had exhausted itself and was now either recharging or standing down while another was ready to continue the assault. An order formed in my head, but dalliance had already anticipated it. While her bubble was still raised, hatches in her hull opened to release several dozen lampreys, small autonomous vehicles equipped with weapons and limited-range skein drives. The lampreys grouped into squadrons and raced to the limit of the bubble. The bubble's hardness was turned down sufficiently for the lampreys to slip through into open space and then restored to full effectiveness. Debris slipped inside the bubble during that interval of permeability, drumming against the hull like the claws of 1,000 witches. The lampreys served 2 functions. 3 squadrons of 4 apiece remained near the bubble, while keeping the horizon of the bubble between themselves and the computed origin of the beam. The other 6 squadrons sped away from dalliance in all directions, skein drives at maximum output. Each lamprey was carving a furrow for itself in the debris field, using gamma rays to ionize the particles into a plasma that could be diverted electrostatically. It made the lampreys hideously visible, but that was hardly a concern now. The lampreys grouped around the bubble, applied force to the hardened field, and, with their drive synchronized, pushed dalliance onto a different heading. After a few seconds, they altered course, denying the enemy any hope of predicting my movements. The combined effect of the lampreys could never be as powerful as the main engine, but the acceleration was still violent enough that I was at the mercy of the dampening field. Then the weapon found me again. The bubble had barely had time to recover from the last onslaught, and now that red line was beginning to creep to the right again. On another part of the console, I witnessed the demise of 2 of the nearby lampreys, caught by energy re-radiating from the surface of the bubble. The remaining 10 were still capable of pushing dalliance, but my evasive swerves and feints would be more sluggish than before. By then, the other 24 units had begun to fire at the source of the beam, using the same gamma cannons that had cleared their paths through the debris cloud. On the main screen, the one that occupied the entire width of the bridge, I could even see their beams, etched bright by scattered and downshifted light as they gouged their way through the cloud. They formed a pattern like the spokes of a wheel, converging on my hidden assailant. I stared at the advancing red line on the console, conscious that the swerves were doing little to hamper the enemy. He was close enough that light-speed time lag could be easily accounted for, or perhaps ignored altogether in his weapon's targeting calculations. Abruptly the beam flicked off me and concentrated its attention on the 24 lampreys, picking 3 of them off in close succession. The wheel was now missing 3 spokes. In the instant before the beam returned, I had dalliance tune down its bubble and fling out another 4 lampreys, exhausting its entire arsenal until more could be manufactured. The beam found me again, as I had known it would, but the red line had crept perceptibly back to the left as some of that energy was dissipated. 2 of the lampreys remained with dalliance, assisting the other tugs, while the other pair sprinted out in opposite directions to augment those already arranged in the wheel formation. The beam remained fixated on me most of the time, only occasionally snapping off to eliminate one or two elements of the wheel. There was only one weapon out there, which was a blessing. Had there been two, I doubt that dalliance would have survived for so long. I would either be dead or adrift in a bubble, with every expectation of dying soon after. I was down to 8 lampreys, divided equally between those serving as tugs and those returning fire against the enemy, when the weapon exploded. It blew a moon-sized hole in the debris cloud, a hole that was snatched away by our mutual velocity. When the seconds dragged on and the attack failed to resume, I allowed myself a flicker of gratification. At the same time, I recognized that I was still in no position to drop my guard. I ordered the 8 remaining lampreys to group ahead of dalliance, then engaged the engine. This time I permitted the bubble to drop completely, so that the drive could operate at maximum efficiency. I chose to trade speed for armor, to put as much distance between myself and the enemy as I could. I had destroyed their weapon, but the ghost signal was still there. That was when Hesperus called through. "Campion," he said, his image flickering into grainy unreality before me. "It appears that you have been attacked. Have you sustained damage? Are you debilitated?" "I'm still here," I said, having to raise my voice. I was pushing the engine harder than it liked. The noise was like some infernal threshing machine about to strip its gears. Surges of unchecked acceleration signaled the dampness struggling to compensate. "Thanks for asking," I went on. "It looks as if the signal was a lure. I should have known better than to go after it, when it wasn't purely gentian." Hesperus had closed to within a minute of me. "But you are quite uninjured." "Intact. So's my ship. But I think the point has been proved. Fescue was right to warn us away from this system. It's a nest of snakes. The sooner we're out of here, the better." "I have an obstructed line of sight to Purslane. I shall inform her of your narrow escape. In the meantime, may I offer assistance?" "I'll be fine once I've cleared the cloud. Concentrate your efforts on making sure you and Purslane get clear. Tell her to ignore all signals."
"You are certain there are no survivors?"
"Look at this place, Hesperus. It was wishful thinking all along." But even as I was answering him, there was a chime from my console. I glared at the readout, in no mood to deal with another piece of news. Dalliance had just detected another signal. It was coming from a different location than the last one. It was stronger, powerful enough to suggest someone was tracking us and aiming a signaling device. It was also unambiguously gentian. My hand hovered before the console. Reason compelled me to ignore this new signal, especially given what I had just told Hesperus, but I could not bring myself to dismiss it.
"Campion?"
"There's a new signal. It's gentian, using the most recent protocols."
"A distress code?"
"Yes."
"If an ambush happened here, it might not be unreasonable to assume that distress signals would have been sent from many ships. Can you be sure that the enemy did not intercept such a signal, and is now simply duplicating it?"
"If they could do that, why didn't they start with a true gentian signal?"
"I have no answer for that," Hesperus said quietly.
"But I would still urge a caution.
Should I inform Purslane of developments?"
"Wait," I said, my hand still hovering before the console. Dalliance was now telling me that it had detected a second layer of embedded content in the signal, not merely a distress code, but a modulation on that transmission that could be interpreted as an audio-visual image. My hand still hovered. If I opened the message, it might be persuasive. I might not wish to be persuaded. I could turn around now and argue that all I had done was ignore a second lure, albeit one constructed with more care than the first. Perhaps the enemy had only switched to a gentian format when they concluded that I was likely to be a shattering of that line.
"Campion," Hesperus said, "forgive me for taking this liberty, but I decided to inform Purslane of the message."
I was more bewildered than angry. "I told you not to."
"I felt that the information was too important not to disseminate. Purslane now knows that there is an agency in this system capable of imitating gentian signals. That agency may be gentian, but equally it may not be. Now she has that information, and it may help her even if we are destroyed."
I did not have the energy to argue with Hesperus. especially when a begrudging part of me knew he was right. Did she say anything?
Perslane was of the opinion that it would be wise to ignore the message. She argued this point most strenuously.
I smiled. I had no doubt that Hesperus was understating the matter. At the same time, I ordered Dalliance to play the audio-visual transmission, projecting it into the air onto a flat surface just beyond the circular disk of the control platform. A face appeared. I knew her. Her name was Mazerion. She was one of us.
"I hope I'm talking to Campion," she said. "I think I must be. That ship of yours, I'd recognize it anywhere. I must have told you to get rid of it a dozen times, but I'm so glad now that you didn't. I'm sorry you were attacked, but I didn't notice you until then. Please don't respond just yet, not until we're closer. I could see you from half the system away now, but I'm still camouflaged, and I hope no one is listening in on this beam."
Mazerion licked her dry, colourless lips as if she was thirsty. She was a plain woman by the standards of the line. The most attractive Gentian attributes, the cheekbones, the mismatched eyes, the shape of the mouth, had been toned down almost as far as they could go without vanishing altogether. Her hair was tied back in simple fashion, pulling the skin on her forehead drummed tight. She wore a purple dress or blouse that left one shoulder bare, and the readout crammed wall behind her told me she was speaking to me from inside a ship.
"I guess you know something about the ambush by now," she said. "I was in abeyance, primed to be woken if anything went off. When they opened fire with the spitting cobra, I knew someone must have arrived."
A sudden savage anger transformed her features.
"They didn't get us all. There are other shatterlings with me, a handful I managed to pick up while all hell was breaking loose, and I'm sure there are more hiding out around the system, and there are our prisoners. But we can't move, we can't leave. I don't have an engine anymore. I could crawl out of this cloud, but they'd catch up with me sooner or later."
I mouthed a question, half whispered. "What do you want me to do about it?"
Mazerion breathed in heavily. "Time's running out for us. We're out of synchromesh and I've already used up 9 lives in the stasis cabinet. My ship's dying. It can't repair itself anymore, and the impasse's about the last thing still working."
She looked at me with a probing intensity, as if our eyes were meeting and she was daring me to look away.
"Let me know you've received this message, even if you choose not to act on it. Alter your course just enough to send me a signal. I want to know that someone got it. Because there's something you need to know, something you need to get to the rest of line, even if you leave us here to die. I told you about the prisoners. Fescue didn't know about them, so I don't think there's any way you can know about them either. We got something out of one of them. His name's Grilsa. He's a rogue shatterling of Marcelin line. That's how they got hold of the H-guns. But don't blame the Marcelins just yet. We think Grilsa and his friends were acting alone. If this is Campion I'm speaking to, I don't know how you're going to take this, but Grilsa told us that this was somehow your fault."
Mazerion shook her head in frustration.
"No, I don't mean fault. I mean somehow something you did, innocently enough, led to this. You were the catalyst. You triggered the ambush, whether you knew it or not."
"How could I have triggered it?" I asked, stunned. "How could I have triggered it when I wasn't even here?"
I relayed Mazerion's message to Perslane so that she could hear the part about the Marcelins and my supposed involvement in the ambush. I did not wait for her answer before beginning my turn. A few moments later, Hesperus shadowed my course change, powering hard to position his ship ahead of mine. He must have been notching close to 5,000 Gs, far beyond the capabilities of any dampening field I had ever heard of. Mazerion was not long in responding.
"Thank you, Campion. I hoped you might turn, but I didn't dare count on it. Whatever happens, you have my undying gratitude. I know bad things have been said about you, including things said by people like me, who should have known better. You didn't deserve any of that. You're a jewel in the line, someone we can all be proud of."
"Wait until I've rescued you," I said.
"I'm sending you our position now," Mazerion said. "It's not precise, but I can't determine it any more accurately than that. When you get close, you should be able to sniff us out from our bubble spillage. I'll do what I can to talk you in, of course. I still think it would be unwise for you to signal me directly."
Numbers appeared on the console. On the main screen, an icon popped into existence against the brown smear of the cloud. Mazerion lay about 15 degrees north of the original signal, a little deeper inside the veil.
At my present acceleration, I would arrive at her position inside the hour. I stared intently into the fog of pulverized planet, in the absurd hope that my eyes might pick out some buried threats before the infinitely more acute senses of my ship. Hesperus, who was still able to talk, said, "She mentioned a spitting cobra. I confess my memory is silent on the matter."
"Do you know much about wormholes, Hesperus?"
"A little. The rebirthers use them for rejuvenating stars."
"That's because there's not much else you can use them for. They're a joke from God. Maybe the Priors found a way to send ships and information down them, but if they did, we don't have a clue how it's done. The best we can do is squeeze matter down them, fine for siphoning fuel from one star to another, but not much use for anything else. Maybe the machine people have figured out a way to embed information into that matter flow, but we've never managed it. Modulate the flow at one end, the signal is still smeared out by the time the matter emerges."
"We encountered the same difficulty," Hesperus said.
"Well, lucky for us, you can use wormholes to kill things. You take a rebirther wormhole, but you only anchor one end in a star. You let that fuel spew out of the other end into naked space. Surround the throat with machinery to open and close the flow of matter, and to aim it at whatever you want to kill. It's a flamethrower, basically."
"Would the other end be in this system?"
"Doesn't have to be. Could be hundreds of years away. One star might have multiple taps leading to multiple throats."
"Do you think there was more than one of them here?"
"No way of telling, I'm afraid. We might not even have damaged the one we hit. Disabled the throat mechanisms, maybe. But I doubt we did anything that can't be fixed given time."
"Why would they use that weapon and not the H-guns?"
"Range, basically. A spitting cobra's got a longer reach, even if it isn't as destructive. Someone had to get close in with those homunculus weapons. If the ambushers took out the Reunion world, they would have needed to be nearby before they did it."
"Could the H-guns have been concealed?"
"Only inside ships."
"The ships would be seen," Hesperus said.
"But no one would suspect anything if they were ships of the line, arriving with Gentian recognition signals."
Hesperus did not respond at first. I do not think he was shocked by my suggestion, but more that he wished to accord it a respectful silence. Given the evidence, I had little doubt that he had drawn a similar conclusion himself. The ambush could not have happened without Gentian collaboration. The consul chimed to inform me that Meserion was signaling me again. Her message was brief, simply a string of coordinates. Dalliance adjusted her course minutely and gave me an ETA for the rendezvous. Allowing for deceleration, we would be on Meserion's position in 12 minutes.
"Campion," Hesperus said after a while, "I do not wish to alarm you, but I am seeing something beyond Meserion. It was not there a few moments ago. Whatever it is large, and it is moving towards us."
Dalliance pushed its faculties to the limit, lowering its detection thresholds now that I had independent evidence that something else was lurking in the cloud. In a few moments, something appeared in the displayer, a hazy blob, framed in a box and accompanied by the exceedingly sparse data my ship had managed to extract. The object was well camouflaged, but large, 5 or 6 kilometers wide, and Hesperus had been right about it coming nearer.
"It could be a big ship, or a big ship carrying a homunculus weapon, or just one of the weapons on its own," I said.
"I see smaller signals grouped around it. Other ships, perhaps."
At that moment, Meserion returned. We were close enough now that she was able to send an imago without risk of interception. The figure appeared before me, to the right of Hesperus. She was trying to be firm, but there was a crack in her voice that she could not quite conceal.
"You have to turn back now, Campion. They're moving one of the H-guns onto you. If you turn tail and go to maximum power, you may stay out of range. They'll still chase you, but maybe you can keep ahead of them."
This time Meserion's message protocol permitted me to answer her.
"They must have been counting on killing me with the spitting cobra, but I damaged it."
"Good for you," she said, a gleam of admiration in her eyes. "It won't stop them, but at least you showed them there's still fire in the line."
"I hope so."
"Turn around now. You've done your best, Campion. But there's no sense in dying to make a point. I've told you what I can. I wish I could have given you the prisoners, but..."
"I'm still coming in," I said.
"If you are committed to this rescue," Hesperus said. "Then I will do what I can to draw the fire of the homunculus weapon. I will pass Miserion's position at speed and increase my visibility."
"Are you certain about doing this?"
"Already committed. I will make my closest approach to Miserion's position in 3 minutes. Then I will adjust my impasse emissions and engine signature to lure the homunculus weapon. Even if it can still see you, I doubt that it will be able to resist a closer target."
"Whatever happens, Hesperus, I'm grateful."
"I am going silent now. I shall see you in interstellar space, when we have put this unfortunate place behind us."
His imago rippled and vanished, leaving me alone with Miserion.
"You were just talking to a machine person, weren't you? How in God's name did you pull that off?"
"I'm full of surprises."
The next 3 minutes passed like an age, as I watched Hesperus streak forward and then slam past Miserion's position, missing her by barely 500,000 kilometers. By then, my view of the approaching object and its escort of ships had improved substantially. That it was a homunculus weapon was beyond argument. I was seeing it from a foreshortened perspective, but Dalliance was able to extrapolate its true form, and the delicate, slender-stalked, flower-like shape, its more a coronet of diaphanous petals veined like dragonfly wings, was an uncanny match against data in the trove. It must have arrived hidden in the belly of one of our ships, but there was no need to conceal it now. The slender form might have looked vulnerable, but that fragility was deceptive. The field-reinforced, field-armored weapon was being propelled by tugs much like my own lampreys. They were clamped onto the stem like thorns, and had sharp, skein-drive signatures. Once he had passed Miserion, Hesperus began to tune his hull to make himself more conspicuous. He fired his own weapons against the homunculus device and its escort vehicles, not with any obvious expectation of doing harm, but in the hope of goading it into a response. His drive emissions became noisier. Hesperus could have been tracked from across the system by now. Perslane would have been aware of his actions, even if she did not grasp their full significance. A minute later I began my own slowdown. Dalliance forewent all its usual safeguards. The engine screamed in my ears, the dampeners warning that they could not guarantee to neutralize the thousands of G-forces trying to keep me moving in a straight line. I grimaced and sank deeper into my seat, hands clasping at the armrests, as if that would make the slightest difference if the dampeners failed. As the distance between Dalliance and Miserion's ship dwindled to thousands of kilometers and then hundreds, I got my first clear look at the vessel I had come to rescue. Miserion had done everything she could to camouflage herself, but she had not been able to work miracles. Her ship was a wreck, damaged beyond obvious repair. It was a lozenge-shaped hull, just less than a kilometer from end to end, and about a fifth of a kilometer across the beam. Where her engine had been was a perfectly spherical hole, as if a giant had taken a crunching bite out of the ship. At the forward end of the ship, the nose was split open like a ruptured seed pod. Evidence of smaller weapon or collision impacts peppered the hull with silvery craters, stark chrome flowers against the midnight black of the intact parts. But Miserion had been inventive. She still had a working impasser, and she had gathered several million tons of rubble inside the bubble with her ship, dressing it around the wreck to form a gauzy screen that would offer some concealment if the bubble failed. Beyond the bubble, several larger chunks of rock had been arranged to provide secondary camouflage. Seen in close-up, it looked unnatural, big boulders apparently coalescing into a baby asteroid, with a glassy marble at the heart of that swarm of rubble, but you must have been counting on never coming under direct scrutiny. "I'm very near you now," I said. "Cargo bay's already open. There's enough room for you inside, but you'll have to drop the bubble and lose your camouflaging screen." "I'm scared. They're close enough now that, if I do drop my bubble, they'll have no trouble finding me again."
"You told me your bubble was about to give up the ghost anyway. You've nothing to lose."
As I completed the final phase of my approach, my deceleration dropping down to mere G's of slowdown, my attention flicked back to Hesperus. He had begun to steer, while still maintaining a steady assault against the homunculus weapon. He must have had some effect, for two of the escort vehicles had begun to peel off to close in on him. But the weapon itself was showing no inclination to follow his bait. The two escort craft were accelerating hard as they made their turn, nearly as hard as Hesperus himself. Dalliance came to a halt just beyond Miserion's last layer of camouflaging boulders. Her bubble flicked off,
and her ship began to inch forward on impellers, nosing clear of the rubble that had been trapped within the bubble. The boulders carved silvery gouges in her hull as they knocked against her, splintering and pulverizing in the process. The impellers began to glow a vivid pink, signifying some worrying ailment deep inside their mechanisms. Never mind. All they had to do was get her another few hundred meters, and then they could be scrapped. I assigned two of the lampreys to rearrange the rubble into a makeshift screen between us and the homunculus weapon. With enough intelligence not to need direct supervision, they set to work in a blur of furious motion, zipping back and forth too quickly for the eye to track. While the lampreys were busy, I spun dalliance around to bring the bay into alignment and dropped my own field. The lampreys buzzed around me like busy fireflies, doing their best to shepherd away the larger rocks that had been disturbed by Miserian's emergence. All of a sudden, even the wreck of her ship looked too big to fit, as if I had misjudged the capacity of my cargo bay. "Disengage your impellers," I told Miserian. "You have enough momentum now. I'll take care of the rest." At that moment, it was as if half the sky had been clawed back to reveal a blinding whiteness beyond it, as if the black of night was just an eggshell-thin layer masking an unimaginably cruel brightness. On the console hovering above me, Dalliance recorded a litany of complaint, moderate damage sustained across a large acreage of the hull, one of the fireflies out of action. Miserian's imago flickered and reformed.
"They just used it."
I nodded. I had guessed as much for myself. "Are you hurt?"
"I think the rubble took the brunt of it. We're still outside its effective kill range. Did you take a hit?"
"Nothing that can't be fixed, and nothing that'll stop us getting away." I did not care to think about what would happen when that weapon came closer. Technically, it had not even touched us. My hands trembling, I watched as Miserian's ruined ship began to drift into my cargo bay, with what appeared to be no more than angstroms of clearance in any direction. Dalliance clanged as something knocked against it, but the slow drift continued. Switching to an internal view, I saw the wreck force its way into the bay as if some obscene creature was striving to raid the snug burrow of another animal. Bits of Miserian's ship, especially around the existing damaged spots, were ripping away.
The sky beyond the sky whitened again, brighter this time, turning the bay and the ship into pink-edged silhouettes, and Dalliance let me know that she had sustained more damage. One of the boulders tumbled away from the screen that the lampreys had erected, and it was glowing red on the side that had been facing the weapon. Then Miserian was clear of the doors. Grapples moved in to lock her ship into position. I reinstated my bubble and gave the command to move. With fewer lampreys to push her along, Dalliance could not sustain her former rate of acceleration. I decided I would risk stuttering the bubble, allowing the engine to contribute to the effort. At 1,000 G's, the wall of boulders dropped away behind me with disarming swiftness. It was tempting to think that I had already put sufficient safe distance between myself and the homunculus weapon, but that was not the case. When I relocated Vespertine, I saw Hesperus was taking her towards the weapon, having executed a hairpin turn that would have crushed most ships, let alone their human occupants.
"Hesperus," I whispered, "don't do this. We're getting away all right."
As if he could have heard me, or would have listened even if he could. The weapon fired again. This time there was a jagged and asymmetric quality to the wash of light as it branched across the sky. When it abated, something brachiform and luminous remained. The weapon had made a lesion. They must have been pushing it to its limit in their determination to kill me. There was nothing more I could do to improve my chances. Dalliance was giving her all to get away as quickly as possible, and my fretting would make no difference whatsoever. Yet I could not turn away until I had seen what would become of Hesperus.
Chapter 12. "Did you see him die?" I asked.
"Yes," Campion said. "I'm sorry, for you and for him."
We were aboard Dalliance, lying together. We had cleared the cloud and were now in interstellar space, returning to cruise speed. I had whisked over as soon as Campion's ship was in range of mine. We had embraced, holding each other so tightly that it was as if our coming back together was only provisional, a state of affairs that might be rescinded at any moment if the universe changed its mind. We had kissed, and then our kissing had become an exercise in frenzied exploration, as if the hours that we had been apart had been long enough to dull our memories of each other. We lost our clothes and made love, dozing into half-sleep before starting anew, until we both fell into blissful unconsciousness, weary but glad to have survived. Now we were awake again, holding on to each other like two exhausted swimmers, each using the other for support. "I should introduce you to the new guests," Campion said, after a long silence during which I had almost fallen back into dream. "Are they all right?" I checked on them, obviously. Only Aconite and Mazerion are awake at the moment, but I thought I'd save the big welcome until you could share in it. I suggested they wait in the gardens until you were ready. "What about the prisoner or prisoners? Did you find out anything more?" "Nothing beyond what Mazerion already told me, that this was all somehow caused by me. For all we know, Mazerion got the wrong end of the stick, or the prisoner was feeding her a lie. A lie that just happened to include me as a detail." I had no answer for that. We washed, clothed ourselves, then whisked through ship to Dalliance's gardens. I did my best to hide my concerns from him, but all the while my mind was spinning through the possibilities. How could the ambush have had anything to do with Campion, if he had been so conspicuously late for the reunion? It made no sense unless the cause of it was something that had happened during the last reunion, something in Campion's thread, in other words. But if that was the case, then we were dealing with an agency that thought nothing of plotting our demise across a timescale of an entire circuit, longer than the lifespan of some planetary civilizations. Someone, in other words, prepared to be as patient as a snake. "Everything goes back to the vigilance," I said. Campion opened the door in the stone wall that encircled the gardens. "What does the vigilance have to do with anything?" "Think about it for a moment. If you hadn't visited the vigilance in your previous circuit, you wouldn't have been saddled with delivering Dr. Menninx to them. If you hadn't had to deliver Dr. Menninx, we'd never have been back to that sector of the Scutum Crook's arm. No centaurs, no Ateshka, and more than likely no being late for the reunion. And no Hesperus either. He'd still be Ateshka's prisoner. See what I'm getting at? I'm still not sure what all this has to do with what Mazerion said." "Maybe nothing, but if all those occurrences hung on your visit to the Vigilance, how do we know something else didn't? It formed the central part of your strand a circuit ago. What if there was a detail in your memories, something to do with the Vigilance, that someone didn't like?" "What kind of detail?" Campion could be almost superhumanly exasperating. "No idea. But in the absence of anything better, shouldn't we at least consider the possibility?" "That would mean going back over my thread," Campion said, as if that was somehow an insurmountable obstacle. "Maybe we should see what the prisoners have to say first." Of all the spaces in Campion's ship, I liked the gardens the best. We had emerged through a gate in a tall ivy-clad stone wall. From the gate we had followed a winding pathway down a gently sloping meadow set with sculptures, sundials, water clocks, wind chimes, elegant moving statuary and foaming iron fountains into a bower enclosed by trees. At the center of the bower was a small summer house, a round wooden building with a conical roof, surrounded by a moat of water, which in turn connected to a larger pond, the moat spanned by a red-painted bridge of Chinese design. The visible sky was the cloudless enamel blue of 100,000 worlds. The layout of the gardens, the agreeable climate of that eternal sunny afternoon, never varied. There were stars in the sky that had not existed when the soil in these gardens was first laid down. There were stars that had shone then that were now veils of dead gas, rushing into darkness. Civilizations beyond number had risen from obscurity, considering themselves masters of all creation, before fading back into the footnotes of history. Mazerion and Aconite were waiting in the summer house, sitting on one of the benches with food and wine on a tray between them. "Hello, Purslane," they said in near unison, as I ducked into the shadowed interior with Campion just behind me. "I'm glad you both made it," I said. "We are making it, aren't we?" Mazerion asked, directing her question at Campion. She had short blonde hair the color of sun-dried straw, and pale, almost translucent skin, with a delicate mottling of honey-colored freckles across her cheeks. "Too soon to tell, I'm afraid," Campion said. "We're putting distance between us and the enemy, but I won't feel truly safe until this system is just a bad memory." "I meant to ask, Aconite said, pausing to sip from the goblet he held. He was muscular and dark-skinned, with a black beard, raffishly flecked with silver and a mass of jangling rings hanging from one earlobe.
Did you hear from anyone else? We knew we were all right, obviously, but we couldn't risk broadcasting our presence to the rest of the cloud.
If there was anyone else there, Campion said, I didn't hear from them.
Sorry. Wish the news was better.
Not your fault, old man.
The only other survivor we know about is Fescue, I said, taking a place on the opposite bench, kicking off my shoes and hugging my legs, my arms encircling my shins. We ran into his transmission. He tried to talk us out of entering the cloud, but we decided to take a shot at it.
Mazerion looked sharply at Aconite, then me.
Then I guess you don't know about Fescue.
He's dead, Aconite said. He stayed behind when most of the survivors had already managed to get out of the system. That transmission must have been one of his last acts. The news hit me hard. I had taken it for granted that Fescue was one of the living. How else would he have been in a position to send his warning, if he had not made it through the ambush?
What happened? I asked. Engine trouble?
Mazerion shook her small pale head wearily. Fescue was trying to create a distraction, to keep the ambushes occupied so that a few of us could get away. He could have escaped if he'd chosen to, but he was thinking of the line.
I misjudged him, I said.
You weren't the only one, Campion said, looking down shamefacedly.
Let's not get maudlin, Aconite said. It's enough that we have survived to commemorate him. Burnish his name and all that stuff. We'll do the old bastard proud.
He gave Campion an encouraging punch.
Right, old men?
Right, Campion said. Mazerion poured herself some more wine while Aconite chewed the end off a loaf of bread. Outside, birds twittered and breezes stirred the reeds around the summer house's little moat.
Are there just the two of you? I asked.
We're the only ones up and awake, Aconite said. There are three others in abeyance. Lucerne, Melilot, and Valerian, and the prisoners, of course.
Campion leaned over to take a grape from the platter.
Is there anything else you need in the meanwhile? Medical attention, anything like that?
Our two new guests looked at each other momentarily before Mazerion answered for them both.
We're fine. It's been stressful, but the ships looked after us well. If there'd been a problem with rations or life support, one or more of us would have gone into permanent abeyance. Thankfully, it never came to that.
Have you been awake ever since the ambush? I asked.
We'd have gone mad from the tension if we hadn't had abeyance, Mazerion said. We took turns. The ship was instructed to bring one or two of us out if it detected something anomalous. It could have been Lucerne or one of the other two, but it was our turn.
This may not be the best time to talk about it, Campion said, but it would have been difficult to get one of those weapons close to the reunion planet unless it was hidden.
Inside one of our ships? Aconite asked.
I hate to think it, but...
You're right. There were three of those weapons, and the spitting cobra in the ships of Saffron, Scabius, and Tar. But they weren't involved. Their ships must have been captured, the line protocols correct. Aconite kept looking at Campion as if there could be no other explanation, that to think otherwise was a kind of heresy. They couldn't have been complicit, if that's what you're thinking.
At this point, we shouldn't rule anything out, Campion said.
Mazerion sighed through her nose.
It's about time we faced up to line involvement, Aconite. Even Fescue had his suspicions. He couldn't understand how the private network had been broken into. Unless one of us was complicit.
Involvement doesn't necessarily mean willing involvement, Aconite said.
Then he raised his big hands defensively. Let's not fall out over this. There'll be time to ask the unpleasant questions when we make it to the fallback. I won't flinch from asking them if the evidence points that way.
I took a bit of bread for myself.
Nor will I.
Mazerion brushed a hand against the iron-grey casing of Melilot's cryophagus.
We should wake them up. It's what we agreed we'd do if there was a change in our situation.
Be kinder not to, Aconite said, at least until we know we're definitely in the clear.
We can move them into Dalliance, at least, Campion said. I've got plenty of sleepers aboard her already, so a few more won't hurt. It's easier to keep an eye on them when they're all together.
Didn't have you down as the guest-carrying sort, Mazerion said with an amused smile.
Just the way things worked out, Campion said.
The prisoners were in a different room from the gentian chatelings. Miserium strode to the first cabinet, worked the heavy clasp, and flung wide the patterned brass doors.
Inside lay a scaffold of ancient machinery, a framework supporting an array of impassers energizing a containment bubble. The bubble's near transparency made it resemble a globe of blown glass, large enough to swallow a throne. Inside the bubble floated another kind of framework, this one supporting time compression mechanisms. They created a secondary bubble, scarlet-tinged as if the glass had been stained. Inside the bubble hovered a chair, edges curved to fit inside the confines of the field. Inside the high-backed throne, secured against involuntary movements, was a human figure. The figure had the deathly stillness of a hologram, but it was neither dead nor holographic.
"Is this Grilsa?" I asked, remembering what Miserion had already told Campion.
"As far as we know," she said, "there was a Grilsa in the Marcelin line circuits ago, and of course the Marcelins were given responsibility for the H-guns, but until we can get into his skull we won't know for sure."
"How did you catch them?" Campion asked.
"Some chatterlings had broken cover and were making a run for interstellar space," Miserion said. "The ambushers tried to stop them. They really didn't want any of us ever to leave that system. Fescue intercepted one of the ambushers' ships and damaged it badly, and the other gentians were able to make their escape. I don't think Fescue ever found out that there were survivors still aboard the ambusher ship. He was dead by the time we pulled them in."
Campion frowned. "What do you mean?"
"The damaged ambusher drifted within range of my ship. On the chance that it might contain weapons or supplies we could use, we decided to risk dropping the impasser and sending out a shuttle. It was a risk. Don't think we didn't argue about it." She looked steadily at Aconite. "I didn't approve, I'll admit that. But in the end it was the right thing to do. There wasn't much we could use aboard the wreck, but we got the four prisoners." She sneered. "Cowards. If they'd had a fucking atom of courage, they'd have killed themselves rather than run the chance of falling into our hands."
"We put them into stasis almost immediately," Aconite said. "The cabinets are old, but they were all we had. If we'd left them in ship time, there'd have been a chance of them escaping, alerting the other ambushers or finding a way to commit suicide."
"And before you locked them away?" I asked.
"We interrogated them as best we could," he said. "Didn't get anything useful, though."
"Except from Grilsa," I said.
"That was after he went into the casket."
Miserion touched part of the casket to the left of the doors, causing a hidden panel to reveal itself. It was set with heavy brass controls, ornately engraved dials and clocks. The main control was a lever running in a graduated quadrant from left to right. At the moment the lever was pushed 4/5 of the way to the right, at a setting of 100,000. That was enough to ensure that a second of time as experienced in the stasis cabinet equaled a day as measured beyond it. The logarithmic control could be pushed all the way to the right, giving a time ratio of 1,000,000. But even with the best equipment, that was a setting to be used under emergency conditions only.
"He's safe enough now," Miserion said, with one eye on the Marcelin. "But when we dialed him back down, we started to see signs of unstable field collapse. We held him low enough to reach with Synchromesh so we could talk in person, but we didn't want to push our luck."
"I don't blame you," I said. "And the others?"
"Just as risky, if not more so. Grilsa's cabinet is the best of the four. The other three are in even worse repair."
Miserion closed the control panel, then swung shut the patterned doors. "I wouldn't recommend attempting to bring him out until we reach the Belladonna world. At least there, we'll be able to call on the technical assistance of the rest of the line."
"What's left of it?" I said.
"There'll be more of us at the fallback," Miserion said. "Call that an act of faith if you will, but if I didn't believe that, I'd end myself. Voluntary attrition."
"We all feel that way," Campion said.
Aconite turned to him. "Did you tell Perslane what Grilsa told us?"
"She knows."
"And what do you both make of it?"
"I'd love to ask Grilsa in person," Campion said.
Aconite's smile was grim. "You'll get your chance, don't worry about that."
"I believe, Grilsa," I said. "It's not comfortable, but why would he invent a detail like that unless it had some substance?
It doesn't make Campion complicit in any of this.
And Dr. Menninx, what does he have to say? Mazarian asked.
Not a lot lately, Campion said.
He died, I said. Tank failure.
Aconite winced. Spectacular timing, old man.
Campion raised his hands defensively. It wasn't my fault. I was under strict instructions not to touch his tank, and I didn't.
Aconite clapped him on the back in a comradely fashion. If it makes you feel any better, I'll take a look at the tank. But I can already tell you what I'll find based on all the aquatics I've known. Some rusting piece of junk with nothing inside it, newer than a million years old, just begging to go wrong.
Thank you, Campion said, sounding taken aback.
See? He does have his uses, Mazarian said.
That was when Silver Wings whispered into my brain, telling me there was something vital I needed to know.
The image was a rectangular volume, divided into cubic cells by a scaffold of fine green lines. At one end of the volume was a representation of our two ships, close enough together that they almost resembled a single vessel. At the other end lay a halo of smeared light, indicating the heliopause of the system we had just departed, the boundary where the star's influence became negligible, and beyond which we could consider ourselves to be in true interstellar space. Halfway along the rectangle was a trio of icons representing the three ships that had been pursuing Campion ever since he rescued Mazarian and the others.
We already knew about the three ships, Aconite said. Maybe I'm being dim, but I don't quite see what all the fuss is about.
We had whisked over to my ship. The four of us were standing on Silverwing's bridge, grouped around the central displayer.
One of the three ships is making headway on the other two, I said. That's what the fuss is about.
Aconite scratched at his chin. Now you mention it, that is a bit odd.
The trio of icons formed an elongated triangle, with a lone ship at the apex. We were all accelerating hard. It was only necessary to look at the image for a few minutes to spot the oozing motion of the grid from left to right, with the magnetopause slowly disappearing from the frame.
If they had power in reserve, they'd have used it already, I said. There's only one explanation. I know you thought you saw her being destroyed, Campion, but that third ship can only be Vespertine. She must have survived the attack after all.
A direct hit from an H-gun? Campion asked.
I'm not saying she's in one piece.
But there's been no direct contact from Hesperus himself? Mazarian asked.
Nothing. Only the agreed distress code he installed in the ship. Hesperus is the only one who's supposed to be able to transmit that signal.
Could someone have got aboard and cracked the safeguards? Aconite asked.
Theoretically, yes, but they'd have to be very clever and very quick, and for some reason Hesperus must not have destroyed the signaling apparatus, even though he would have known he was being boarded.
So it could be him, but you can't be sure, Mazarian said.
No way to know for certain until we open up Vespertine and look inside.
Aconite looked concerned.
In other words, let him catch up with us and see what happens.
He can't. We're outrunning him, and short of engine failure, we'll keep on doing so.
He may have some pseudo-thrust in reserve, but given the circumstances, I rather doubt it.
Mazarian bit her lip.
So it's a lost cause.
Unless we go back for him, Campion said.
I nodded. He's sending that signal because he wants our help. He helped Gentian Lion in our moment of need. We can't turn our backs on him now.
I'm probably missing something, Aconite said, but if we turn around now, or even just slow down, won't we be in danger of falling back in range of the killers?
There are other options, I said. I've got a lot of ships in my hold. Some of them can sustain a much higher rate of acceleration than either Dalliance or Silverwings, not forever, but long enough to get to Hesperus and back.
Mazarian still did not look convinced.
Can this really be done? I mean, the idea is nice in theory, but you're going to be cutting things very close.
It can be done, I said.
I had already primed the displayer. Now it showed an icon leaving Silverwings and racing back towards Vespertine. I had overlaid ovoid volumes that indicated the likely range of the enemy's weapons, assuming they were carrying nothing on the scale of the homunculus device or the spitting cobra.
If Hesperus holds his current rate, I continued,
We can reach him without even falling in range of their guns. Then we speed back to Silver Wings and notch back up to maximum acceleration. We'll still lose them and we'll still be able to make the turn to the fallback without being traced.
There's an element of risk, though, said Mazarian.
I shrugged. There's an element of risk in breathing.
It's not that I'm against rescuing him, Aconite said, but from now on every action we take has to be measured against the future existence of the line. There simply isn't room for brave gestures anymore.
I feel the same way, I answered, but I also know that if we don't do this for Hesperus, we've got no right to call ourselves Gentian.
In any case, the line, such as it is, won't be threatened, Campion said, nodding at the other two. Perslane and I are in agreement. You'll stay aboard Dalliance while Perslane and I take one of the ships in Silverwing's hold. Silverwings will have to notch down a bit to allow the other ship to catch up, but she can make up the ground again when we're back aboard.
And you'll both ride that ship back to Hesperus? Mazarian asked.
We've talked about it. Neither of us much likes the idea of continuing without the other, so it makes perfect sense.
There's another way, Aconite said, as if the idea was forming even as he spoke the words. If this Hesperus has done as much for the line as you say he has, then his preservation becomes our responsibility as well, not just yours. I should take that ship.
Unthinkable, Campion said. After everything you've done for us, I don't think so, old man.
I started to say something, but he held his hand up firmly.
It's no good, Perslane. I've made my mind up.
Are you sure?
Mazarian asked quietly.
Resolute.
He nodded forcefully. I mean it. What kind of ship do you have in mind, Perslane?
I've got a Rimrunner scow.
Tasty.
It hasn't been switched on for about 3 million years, planetary. You all right with that?
They built them to last. Just show me how to play the music.
He reappeared as swiftly as he had disappeared. One moment I was in the bay looking at an iron-black sky peppered with Doppler-squeezed starlight. The next there was a chrome and black Rimrunner scow making final approach, as if it had just popped into existence in my wake. Campion, Mazarian and I were aboard almost before the retaining field had clamped the ship into place. That was when we learned what had become of Hesperus.
He was alive when I got to him, Aconite said. He moved slightly. He was aware of me.
But if Hesperus was aware of anything now, there was no evidence of it. His head did not move, nor did his facial expression change. His eyes, which had twinkled between turquoise and jade, were now devoid of intelligence. The only hint that Hesperus was still alive in some arcane sense was the continued movement of lights in the fretted window of his skull. But those lights moved slowly, and their colors were muted, like the last embers of a fire. Yet it must have taken some volition to send that distress transmission. The paucity of life was not the most disturbing thing about Hesperus, however. Even if the lights had been dead, I could have convinced myself that he had placed himself into the machine equivalent of a deep coma, the better to preserve his deep functions while he awaited rescue. But we were not even looking at all of Hesperus. His left side was almost entirely gone, or rather was concealed or absorbed within a misshapen ingot of black and gold metal that appeared to be partly an extension of him and partly an eruption of the fabric of his ship, which had infiltrated and combined with Hesperus's own body. The ship was gone, but we could see the clean, silvery surfaces where Aconite must have sliced through the mass to free Hesperus.
There wasn't time to think it through, he said, as if his actions needed explaining. I barely had time to free him.
Was there any change? I asked.
The lights got a bit dimmer, I think, but they weren't bright to start with. I don't know if that mass was keeping him alive or killing him slowly.
When the ship was damaged, Campion said, its repair systems must have gone haywire. I think Hesperus must have been caught in that. It looks as if the ship was trying to reconstitute him back into its own matrix, mistaking him for some broken component.
Then it was a mistake to separate him from the ship.
Hesperus sent that signal for a reason, I said. He probably knew he couldn't stay ahead of them for much longer. Whatever happens, you gave him a better chance than he had.
I hope so.
I don't know how we're going to get him out of that, though, Campion said,
standing with his hands on his hips, like a gardener surveying a plot of soil. "As far as I'm concerned," I said, "the best thing we can do is put him into abeyance and get him into the care of other machine people as quickly as possible."
"I'm not even sure we have a stasis chamber big enough," Campion said, "and we can't very well start hacking bits of him until he fits inside."
I looked at the slow crawl of the muted lights. "We can't just leave him like this."
"We're not going to," Campion said. "We'll scan him, like you said. And if there's something obvious we can do, something that we can be certain won't hurt him, we will. But if we can't, he'll have to wait until we get to Belladonna. We'll just have to keep our fingers crossed another machine person shows up, a guest of someone who survived, and that they'll know what to do."
"And if they don't show up?"
"We're not miracle workers," he said quietly. "We'll have done the best we can. That's all anyone can hope for."
The scans brought no better news. The structures under that fused black and gold exterior were complex and intertwined, with parts of Hesperus extending deep into the mass and vice versa. Of his left side, including the living arm, little or nothing appeared to have retained anatomical integrity. There was activity within the combined growth, the arterial flow of energy and matter that indicated ongoing processes. Aconite had been fortunate not to sever any of those conduits when he freed Hesperus, but it was distinctly possible that attempting to free him further would do more harm than good. But there was something still thinking inside him, and he did find a way to communicate with us, albeit briefly. It was not long after we had made the turn to Naume, the Belladonna fallback, confident that the pursuing ships had now fallen too far behind to track our movements. I was the one who noticed it, during one of my periodic and increasingly despondent attempts to coax some evidence of recognition from him. I was looking into his eyes and the fretted windows when my attention was snared by a tremor at the edge of my vision. I looked down and saw that the thumb of his right hand, the only visible hand, was quivering from the highest joint, as if a palsy afflicted that digit while the rest of him was paralyzed into total immobility. The thumb had not been moving before. I stared at it in puzzled astonishment for several seconds before I remembered what Hesperus had done with the wine goblet. With a prickling sense that this might be temporary, a window of lucid communication that could close at any moment, I dashed out of the room to the nearest maker and had it spin another goblet into existence. I pressed it into his hand so that the thumb lay against the glass, as if that was going to be all that I needed to do. But the thumb merely scratched a vertical white line into the glass, deepening the cut with each vertical movement. I looked into his face, hoping for a clue, some nuance of expression that would make it all clear. Then I recalled the way he had rotated the goblet in his fingers, as his thumb worked up and down, carving out a picture, line by line, in the manner of a scanning beam. Delicately, I took hold of the glass, his thumb still moving, and started turning it as slowly and smoothly as I was able, and something began to take form. Not a line, but a rectangle of impressions that was too pale and scratchy for me to make out until he was done. I knew when he was finished, because the thumb stopped moving. When I took the glass from his hand and touched the digit, it was as stiff and dead as the rest of him. But the evidence that it had moved was in my hands, scribed indelibly onto the goblet. I held it up to the light and squinted. But at first the array of scratches made no sense at all, and I wondered if what I had seen was no more than a reflex quiver. I was afraid that I so desperately wanted Hesperus to come back to us that I had clutched at the meaningless twitch of a carcass. But there was something in those scratches. It was almost impossibly faint, nearly lost in the noise. But Hesperus had engraved a design into the glass. It was a circular motif, a rim with spokes, like a wagon wheel with a thick hub. "I don't know if you can hear me," I said, addressing the mute form. "But whatever this is, whatever you're trying to tell me, I'm going to find out and act upon it. I promise you that." I had expected no reaction, and there was none.